Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Sarah.
And today on the pod, we're going to talk about updates on Mueller's investigation into the Trump campaign's possible collusion with Russia. We also talked to pod favorite Julie Balutis about the upcoming governor's election in Virginia. Today's episode is brought to you by Quip Electric Toothbrushes. For a free refill pack, go to getquip.com/hellbent.
There's so much to talk about.
But first, well, of course we didn't do a pod. Well, of course we didn't do a pod on Monday when this drops.
I know. So. I feel like we, just based on the news cycle of this week with everything that's happening, not just with a special counsel, but just everything that's happening in the Trump administration, I feel like we could have done a podcast every day because that
easily
is truly how bananas this news cycle has been.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, even more so than normal. And you know that everyone at the White House is freaking the hell out and like calling their lawyer on company time.
Well, there was a really interesting, before we get into all this, there's a really interesting Washington Post article about how Trump administration officials are trying to appear calm on the surface and, right. You know, in public view. But in the background, they're all freaking the fuck out. Trump is himself freaking the fuck out. And I think is having a, you know, waterfall effect on everyone else.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. Yeah. Shit's getting real.
Shit is getting real. But in lighter news, Sarah showed me this awesome article by Merriam-Webster.
Well, yes, it was a tweet that was sent out and we had seven different hellions who flagged it for us, which I loved. Yes. They were like, read this shit.
Also, if you're not following Merriam-Webster on Twitter, I don't know what you're doing with your life. Yeah. I know it sounds weird to follow a dictionary, but they are so good.
I know. Anyway,
so they had an article on the sort of origin of a bunch of hell-based words.
I think I'm assuming it was some sort of like Halloween-themed.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Content. It was like all these, like, where are these words about hell and the devil come from? And so one of them was hellion.
And hellbent. Hellbent was
and
on
hellbent.
There too.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so hellion, I guess, does not come from the word hell, even though it's in it. It comes from a Scottish word like hall, which means a worthless person. But you know what? I'm going to take that to me, you know, like the way that we like we're nasty women, right?
Right.
So
you're going to flip the narrative.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But modern day definition is someone who causes trouble. So.
Right. But like those, that's just the origin of the word.
Right. Right.
It doesn't change the definition, but it is interesting because I would have assumed like hell makes more sense.
It does.
Like
it
that's
makes more
on
sense.
Brand for me.
Yeah. This is why English is the most ridiculous of all the languages. It just makes no sense.
But it was super interesting. I was like, I didn't know that. That's hilarious. I still love the word hellion. It still means like troublemaker. So we're staying with it.
Absolutely. I also just wanted to mention really quickly, I got tons of positive kind of feedback on my bat gratitude check.
Oh my gosh. So many people were so into it. It was hilarious to see it.
I know. And now like a significant portion of my like Twitter like timeline when I'm looking at other people's tweets are people I follow like 25 bat related accounts. So
oh my God.
I give a lot of pictures of bats, aka the puppies of the sky.
That is aggressive. Also, it's Devin, aggressive. By the way, my friend Matt texted me after our latest episode, and he said that I should tell you to keep the CD collection.
I should. People were like very definitive about my CD collection. A lot of people were like, what the hell are you doing? Why do you have CDs? And I'm like, I don't know. I can't get rid of them.
You're
I don't know what to tell
so
you.
So hipster with your CDs. Like CDs are like the new vinyl.
Oh my God. Oh God. Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. I know. Like Hank, when he gets older, is going to be like, what are you doing with your life, mother? And I'm like, I don't know.
He's like, now we have chips in our brains that control everything. What are CDs? What is Twitter? What is even an iPhone? No one has those.
All right, Sarah. So let's get into some listener feedback. The first one has to do with your ghost. So can you tell us about it.
And for those who didn't listen to the last episode, we were joking about how I believe that there's probably some sort of spiritual presence in my office, because every time before we start like really getting into recording the podcast, my microphone randomly mutes. No one touches it. You have to touch it to mute it, but no one is touching it. And it happens every time. And so I was joking with Devin about how there's some petty ass lady in my office. And I'm like all about her. So then Brando tweeted at us, quote, "Are we sure the hellbent ghost is female? Why is she trying to silence Sarah?" Which is an excellent point.
It's an excellent point.
Yeah. It's probably a man. It's probably a
dude who's like, "Ladies talking about politics. Yeah. What the fuck is that?"
Yeah, too shrill. Too shrill.
Oh, that's really funny. Yeah, so don't know gender of the ghost. You're right, it's probably male. Let's just go with that.
Yeah.
Then DT tweeted, quote, "First time listening to Hellbent and appreciate the way they take feedback. I wrote this on disability and agency." So this was about a comment I made about people with disabilities, and sort of it was not taken well because it wasn't a good comment. So she wrote an article, and I thought a really like salient quote was, "It is my belief that the media simply does not grasp that those with disabilities, like those with any other identity, are experts on their own lives and can best speak to the consequences of a policy decision. And that there are also some of us who have legal training and can speak about the law in addition to being disabled." So basically she's talking about the lack of visibility of those with disabilities in media stories about disability.
Yeah.
So...
and we'll link to her article in our show notes.
Yes, absolutely. We have a couple of updates. So Julie and I are going to record Hillary Book Club on Sunday night. So it'll be up for our patrons of $5 or more on Monday. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yes, that's going to be great.
And then also the week of the November 20th, we're going to be going dark. We won't have any shows that week for Thanksgiving break. And so I'm sure that huge and devastatingly juicy news will break while I'm in Florida with my parents.
So as you're luck welcome, would have it.
As luck would have it. So you're welcome in advance for that.
Yeah. Although we might bring our microphones on our respective vacations.
I always do.
Just in case we need to assemble like the motherfucking Avengers.
Oh, yeah. I literally travel with a travel mic at all times now.
That's just like on now. Your person.
On
like,
my person.
Even if you're like going out to brunch or something, it's like,
yeah, you never know.
You get the bat signal.
What if there's a couple of lawyers sitting next to me at brunch?
Oh my talking gosh. About, yes.
Talking about like stuff going on in the White House.
Oh
you never
god.
Know.
Oh my god.
And since it's the first episode of November, we're going to do our Patreon shout for our $10 and up supporters. So thank you so much to Kevin Soli, Lauren Shockey, and Katie Anderson. So thank you again for your support. It really means the world to us.
And we just really appreciate anyone who is able to support us for any amount. It really, really helps. And if you are not on Patreon yet and you want to contribute, you can go to patreon.com/hellbentpodcast. Devin, I'm just so over mediocrity. Mediocre men, more mediocre men, and mediocre toothbrushes.
Yeah, hard same. And that's actually why I use Quip, the new company that's refreshing the way people brush their teeth.
Yeah, I mean, they won't brush away all the mediocre men, but they will brush your teeth. See what I did there?
I'm embarrassed for you. I do, and I'm embarrassed.
We're keeping it in.
So Quip is an electric toothbrush that packs premium vibration and timer features into a super sexy ultra slim design, and that's half the cost of bulkier brushes. So it kind of looks like if Apple designed a toothbrush without that huge price tag. It's really cute. It looks good on my counter.
Yes.
I know that's super superficial, but whatever. And you can even subscribe to receive new brush heads on the dentist recommended 3-month plans for $5, which is good because if you're a gross human being like me and have literally never changed your brush head,
yeah,
you know, this will force you to do it.
Yeah.
So Quip is backed by leading dentists, and Time named it one of the best inventions of 2016. And they made it on Oprah's 2017 New Year's O list. And
yes.
You know that Oprah knows her shit. So
yes.
Let's do that. And best of all, Quip starts at just $25.
Yeah. So right now, go to getquip.com/hellbent to get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/hellbent. That's getquip.com/hellbent. Okay, Devin, so let's get into our main news block, which is talking about all the news that has dropped around the special counsel's investigation, big indictments that came down the pike on Monday, as well as some other interesting updates and new information that has come along with it. So, yeah, we want to do that. But first, I know we wanted to briefly discuss the attack that happened in Manhattan on Tuesday.
Yeah. So on Tuesday, so Halloween, a man drove a truck down a bike path in Lower Manhattan, killing 8 people and injuring 12 more, including 2 children, because he crashed into a school bus. Mm-hmm. And this looks like a terrorist attack. Apparently, they found a note by the alleged perpetrator, basically claiming that it was a terrorist attack. So New York is in our thoughts once again. So, you know, this is a horrible attack on what's supposed to be a, you know, a fun and joyous celebration.
Yeah.
Halloween. Okay. So, Sarah, what the actual fuck is going on with Mueller's investigation? So,
oh my gosh.
Can you sort of take us through the news that dropped on Monday, when, of course, we weren't doing an episode?
I know. I think I tweeted this on Monday from our account, like, hell of a day not to do a podcast, eh?
Seriously. Yeah.
Before we talk about Monday, though, I think we should talk about the news that dropped on Friday.
Right.
Which sort of was the precursor to this news on Monday. So CNN had reported that the special counsel had prepared indictments.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, there were no other major news organizations that confirmed that reporting. Yeah. So there was kind of a question of, you know, is this really true? Like, what's happening? But, you know, I think for me, I was like, I think shit is definitely going down. And I was pretty sure it would be Manafort.
Yeah.
And I was correct. But there was another person listed along with Manafort that I didn't really know about. So, I mean, maybe you can sort of speak to what the deal is there.
Yeah. So Manafort, who, I mean, Mueller literally told him, like, we're going to indict you. So I think no one was really surprised by that one. But he was charged along with Rick Gates, so one of Manafort's associates and someone that also worked on the Trump campaign. They were basically charged with, I mean, everything related to money laundering and defrauding the U.S. government.
you know, I know Mueller really like threw the books at them. I mean, because they, yeah. I mean, the crux of it is that, you know, we've talked about this on the podcast. You know, Mueller has been sort of focused on following the money and getting financial records and paper trail. And this is a paper trail if I've ever seen one.
I know. Well, yeah, and everything from money laundering to false and misleading FARA statement, which is the Foreign Agent Registration Act. So basically, these two guys were working as foreign agents for a foreign government and didn't register. So literally everything from like money laundering and being general dickwads.
yeah.
So and then there was another indictment too, and this one nobody knew about. Nobody called. So it was a man named George Papadopoulos.
And from what I understand it, I don't know if indictment is necessarily the most specific language, because it's a guilty plea.
Right. He pled guilty to making a false statement to FBI investigators. So he basically pled guilty to lying to the government, which is important because it really contrasts. Like, you have Manafort and Gates being charged and pleading not guilty to a laundry list of pretty serious charges. And then you have Papadopoulos, who is pleading guilty to lying to the FBI. So it's really like two very different sort of pieces to this investigation.
And no one saw, we'll get into George Papadopoulos. No one saw George Papadopoulos coming. A lot of people didn't even know who he was. And I don't want to brag or anything, Devin, but we've talked about George Papadopoulos before on this podcast, albeit a little briefly, but we did talk about him.
Yes, we did. We did. He actually was on my whiteboard at one point. I have to like constantly update. So he's not on there now, but he was on there.
Yeah. Is that why you and Alex bought a new house? Is just so you could have a house filled with whiteboards?
Whiteboards. Yeah. Mm. I'm seriously floor to ceiling.
Yeah. It makes sense.
I'm getting like whiteboard paint and just painting an entire wall.
Your whole house is just like a personal skiff.
Yeah, exactly.
Like you're like pretending that you have secure information. And then it's like all set up that way.
Yeah. I love that. So let's first talk about, before we kind of get into the specifics and sort of what this means, and we're going to really focus on the Papadopoulos guilty plea, because I personally think it's the more interesting of the two pieces of information that we have.
Agreed.
So yeah, before we kind of get into the specifics about this indictment and this guilty plea, let's talk about the White House's reaction. I mean, they're not happy about it, clearly.
I mean, it's like more lying and denying, which was just predictable.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. I mean, Sarah Huckabee Sanders gave the world's most painful press briefing on Monday when this news dropped. It was a thing of beauty because I'm a petty ass bitch. But so basically their initial reaction has been to point out that the indictments against Manafort and Gates deal with events and issues that occurred before the Trump campaign. However, Gates is a more interesting problem, I think, to the White House because he was still involved with Trump World and the RNC well after Manafort left the campaign.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Gates worked on the inauguration of Trump, and you know, he was spotted at the White House several times early in the Trump administration. So, and until March, he was working for a pro-Trump like outside group. So he's been pretty heavily involved.
Yeah, so it's not as like clean of a denial narrative as they would want it to be.
So yeah, they're basically just lying.
Yeah,
they're just straight up lying.
Par for the course.
You know, and they're basically just trying to say this has nothing to do with Trump or the Trump campaign. Which, you know, okay, fine, but now we have George Papadopoulos, right? And you know, he is charged and pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his work on the Trump campaign. That is what this guilty plea is. So for him, they're not saying these charges don't relate to the Trump campaign. They're saying that Papadopoulos was nothing more than a volunteer for the campaign.
Which is like what Sean Spicer said about Manafort and or Flynn. It's like, you can try to gaslight us into pretending like these people weren't integral parts of your campaign, but the facts don't lie. And it's like Paul Manafort did not accept payment as campaign chairman or as campaign manager. And so you could say he was a volunteer too. That doesn't mean he didn't have influence, right?
Exactly. Like they're playing a little fast and loose with the definition of volunteer here. And this is an odd lie because Trump himself tweeted out a picture in March, at the end of March 2016. It was a picture, with the caption, like, a national security meeting, and he's sitting three seats away from Papadopoulos.
Yeah, like, they're really trying that whole Mariah Carey, I don't know her defense. But, I mean, there's just too much factual evidence to contradict that. It's, like, bananas. Also, Trump, in the middle of his campaign, sat down with an interview with the Washington Post. And this was at a point where people were like, okay, you don't really have any like foreign policy chops. Like people were sort of putting pressure on Trump being like, who's your foreign policy team? And he was like, right. Foreign policy team. Okay. I guess I got to assemble that. And they picked a bunch of people who weren't super known. And George Papadopoulos was one of the names that Trump rattled off with his interview with the Washington Post, as well as one Carter Page. If someone's a quote unquote low level volunteer, then why was the candidate and now president identifying him by name to a major newspaper? Like, it doesn't add up.
Right. No, not at all. Yeah. And so, I mean, Trump has been predictably calm and collected about the whole situation, obviously.
That is a joke.
That is a joke. Yeah. On Monday, when this news dropped, he said, "Sorry, but this is years ago, before Paul Manafort was part of the Trump campaign. But why aren't crooked Hillary and the Dems the focus? Also, there is no collusion." And also, during this really painful press briefing, Sarah Huckabee Sanders said that there are clear indications that the investigation is wrapping up and everyone can just move on with their lives. Okay.
This is like the waspiest shit I've ever heard. Like, just sweep under the rug, sweep under the rug. Nothing to see here. La, 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 la. You know?
Yeah. And so my sources, which are me, tell me that those indications are the hopes, dreams, and prayers of Paul Ryan's missing in action backbone.
But I don't even think that is Paul Ryan's hopes, dreams, and prayers of his missing backbone, because Paul Ryan was asked about all this shit. And he was like, la, 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 this isn't going to get in the way of tax cuts. Like,
right.
Paul Ryan will stop at nothing to punish the poor. Doesn't matter. Does not matter. Like, that's he doesn't true. Give a fuck. He really just wants to punish poor people. Doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, he's a real dickwad. So, okay. So the White House obviously did not react well to these stories. And people who, like, have sources, like aides in the White House, are basically like, yep, everyone's freaking the hell out. Like, there's a bunch of fans and the shit is just hitting them.
Yep.
What I think we really want to talk about today, though, is the Papadopoulos guilty plea.
Yeah, so I think we should explain what he was lying about.
Yeah.
Because as you said previously, he entered a guilty plea for lying to the FBI. But what was that about?
Okay, so let's back up to January 27th, 2017. So the FBI questioned Papadopoulos and informed him that lying to federal investigators is a crime. So naturally, he lied his ass off. and so now he's being charged for lying to the FBI. And January 27th, if that date sounds familiar, that's because it was the same day that Trump asked Comey for his, quote, loyalty.
Yeah.
So there's a lot going on that day.
That's a really, really interesting potential coincidence.
Right.
We don't really know, but it's like, you know, someone, I forget who pointed it out, but Comey had to know, you know, as director of the FBI, that his agents were interviewing George Papadopoulos that day. So when he went to dinner with Trump and Trump's asking him for his loyalty, in the back of his head, he knows that this Papadopoulos dude lied to them about these sort of Russia contacts, essentially.
Right. Right. So, yes. So basically he lied about his role in the Trump campaign and his sort of work with Russian contact. I'm going to go through a little bit of timeline. This is a little dense, so stick with me, but I promise we're making a point.
I'm with you, Devin. We're all with you.
In March 2016, after Papadopoulos learned that he was going to be a foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign, he met with a London-based professor. And he knew that the professor had substantial connections to the Russian government. He thought he could increase his role by sort of having this connection to this professor that had Russian ties.
Yeah. And just as an FYI, it's a pretty typical practice by Russian intelligence to use these sort of academic scholars as cutouts and like intermediaries for them.
Yeah. Classic Russian tradecraft is what it's been called. So then Trump gave this interview to the Washington Post, naming Papadopoulos as a foreign policy advisor. And, you know, according to the plea agreement, Papadopoulos, you know, has briefed Trump and other foreign policy advisors about his connections to Russians. So Papadopoulos, you know, introduced himself to the group on the national security meeting that Trump tweeted a picture of, and said and stated, quote, in sum and substance, that he had connections that could help arrange a meeting between then candidate Trump and President Putin. So this is directly from Papadopoulos's plea. That he directly briefed top campaign officials and Trump. So yeah, which is pretty damning. So in April, after he had sort of talked about this with the Trump campaign, he began working with this professor who's this Russian cutout and a female Russian national who I believe it was a woman claiming to be Putin's niece.
Yeah, I don't know if she was claiming it or Papadopoulos thought she was.
Yeah.
And got, like, I don't know on what end that sort of originated, but she turned out not to be Putin's niece. Papadopoulos was really stoked on the fact that he thought she was Putin's niece.
Right, right. And so they've sort of been, they start working together to get a meeting in Moscow. And they were reportedly very excited about the potential of this, like, good relationship between Russia and Trump. So then on April 25th, Papadopoulos sent an email to a senior policy advisor of the Trump campaign indicating that the Russians were ready to meet with Trump and suggesting London as the likely location.
At this point, does Papadopoulos know about potentially stolen emails from Hillary Clinton?
Yes.
Which
yes,
is
he does.
Interesting, A, because if these are referring to Hillary Clinton's emails, there's no evidence that those emails were ever actually stolen because they haven't come out yet, right? So we don't, that's still a big looming question. But what's also super interesting is that that means the Trump campaign knew that Russians were stealing emails related to the Democratic candidate and or party before the public knew about that.
Right. And this is where it's a little bit muddy. It's hard to tell if they were talking about the Clinton emails from her private server.
Right.
Or the hacked DNC emails.
I think they are the Russians via Papadopoulos are telling Papadopoulos that they have Hillary Clinton's emails from her private server. That's the sense that I'm getting.
So, and this, what also gets really interesting is there was a footnote on this plea agreement. This was literally like at the bottom of the page that Papadopoulos was not acting on his own. So the sort of rebuttal by the Trump administration and Sarah Huckabee Sanders was that Papadopoulos reached out with this information about potential Russian connection and that they rebuffed him, right? And they said, thank you, no thank you. One of the most important pieces of this plea, though, is that, you know, the there was an official that forwarded Papadopoulos' email about this connection to Putin to another campaign official and stated, let's discuss. We need someone to communicate that Donald Trump is not doing these trips. It should be someone low level from the campaign so as not to send any signal.
Yeah. So they know. They know on some level this is some shady shit.
And so this email exchange where basically Papadopoulos, you know, informed top campaign officials, you know, about this potential meeting in London, that happened in May 2016. And this kind of part puts another part of the story into sharper context, because in July 2016, a low-level guy did, in fact, travel to Russia. It was Carter fucking Page.
Yeah.
Went to Russia in July 2016, and Politico broke this story and actually found out that his trip had been approved in advance by Corey Lewandowski, who was Trump's then campaign manager.
Yeah, so we don't necessarily know that this is... that this matches up, because who knows? There could have been multiple trips, for example. But that's definitely an interesting note. And Carter Page, speaking of Carter Page, oh my God. He went on live TV the other day with Chris Hayes. Chris Hayes got another interview with Carter Page. Like, I don't know, you know, what the magic of Chris Hayes is, but he somehow convinces Carter Page to go on live TV. And Chris Hayes even said, this is either like admirably bold or I forget what or just ridiculous. I don't remember his exact words, but that was basically what he said. But Carter Page, it was super interesting because Chris Hayes was like, were you on email chains with George Papadopoulos? And Carter Page was trying to be kind of evasive and was like, well, I mean, we were in a campaign together, so I'm sure, you know, he was whatever. And then Chris Hayes was like, were you on email chains with Papadopoulos about Russia? And Carter Page was like, well, yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure it came up from time to time. It's like, oh my God.
He's just not the brightest bulb in the box.
He really isn't. And apparently he doesn't even have a lawyer or something like that, which is bananas. But just to backpedal just slightly. So you mentioned in this court document about sort of campaign supervisors who were not named, but who Papadopoulos sent these emails to. They forwarded it along to other people. That person, that campaign supervisor, has since been identified as Sam Clovis, who apparently was also up for a Trump administration position, which he this morning removed himself from contention.
From running.
And apparently he was in no way qualified to do this job, which is, again, another fucking theme of the Trump administration.
Seriously. Like, they just are picking people at basically at random for these jobs. Yeah, no, it is very interesting because there is a clear sort of a pedigree here of who knew what when.
Right.
So Sarah Huckabee Sanders can say that Papadopoulos was a low-level volunteer all she wants, but Mueller has fucking receipts, right? Yeah. Like, these emails were, you know, kind of given to top campaign officials and, in fact, forwarded on to other campaign officials. Mm-hmm. And that everyone knew about this, like, meeting that Papadopoulos was trying to set up with the Russians in London. This is not... Yeah.
And Papadopoulos was told, great work.
Yes.
They were like, good job, dude.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's also interesting because we now know that the Trump campaign was aware of this, that Russians had dirt on Hillary Clinton, including these, quote, thousands of emails, as you know, as of April 2016.
Right.
And then, so remember, on June 9th, 2016, emails to Don Jr., you know, basically saying, we have dirt on Hillary Clinton, do you want to meet? It kind of makes more sense. Right. It didn't exactly come out of nowhere.
Right. There was some prelude to it.
Exactly. And while we do know that Manafort and the Kush were also at the subsequent meeting to discuss this possible Clinton dirt, it almost seems redundant that they were there now because the campaign obviously knew about the Russians' Clinton dirt, right? So it's just, it's a very interesting, you know, we're sort of seeing like
puzzle pieces. There's so many jigsaw puzzle pieces that are sort of over time being connected and put together. And, you know, I mean, Devin and I are going to be completely honest. A lot of this is just, there's so much going on. It can feel hard to keep track of everything and to connect everything because there's a lot.
It is a lot. And I'm not a lawyer and I don't even play one on TV.
but you do on this podcast.
But I do on this podcast. So, you know, we're trying to put together these pieces and sort of like cobble together like what happened. But there's a lot of conjecture and it's really hard to know the specifics. And so, you know, there's a lot to unpack here, right?
Yeah.
Like, we're, you know, just seeing all of this together and sort of like highlighting things that happened and putting other events into larger context. I mean, no matter how you look at it, there's just so much information here.
And I also think it's important to note that on the surface, this Manafort and Gates indictment and then this Papadopoulos guilty plea, on the surface, they don't seem connected, right?
Right.
But there's also some conjectures that that, you know, Mueller might be trying to send a signal to Manafort. Like,
yes,
look at this Papadopoulos guy. He's cooperating. He's probably going to get more leniency. I mean, there's a good chance that he doesn't even get jail time.
Right.
Papadopoulos.
Right. So this is actually it's a pretty sweet deal, right? The charges carries a maximum sentence of 5 years imprisonment and a $250,000 fine and 3 years of supervised release. So, but since he's pled guilty, the government has recommended between 0 and 6 months imprisonment and a fine between $500 and $9,500.
Yeah.
So it's a good deal.
So we covered through April 2016. Now, what happens in July 2016, Devin? Because I think it's important to note as we go through this timeline that no one knew about what was happening in this sort of 9 to 10 month span with Papadopoulos. Everything was kept under wraps, which is of amazing. But what happened in July 2016 or July 2017, excuse me?
In July 2017, that was when the FBI executed a no-knock warrant on Paul Manafort's house. I think we all remember this explosive news where they literally broke in at dawn. And then the day after that search warrant was executed, the government arrested George Papadopoulos.
Right.
And no one knew.
No one knew. It's amazing.
No one knew that he was arrested, and no one reported that an indictment or a guilty plea or, you know, against George Papadopoulos was forthcoming.
Well, because I don't think they had, that had happened at that point.
Right. No, but I'm saying, like, he was arrested in July.
Right.
And you know, obviously he's been talking to the Mueller team and got this great plea deal, and no one knew. Right.
Yeah. This was like
some Beyonce, like Lemonade level, like PR shit.
Management of leaks. I mean, the Trump administration could really learn from Mueller and Beyonce, you know?
Yeah. I mean, this office is not and Beyonce.
Mostly Beyonce.
Somebody get Beyonce on the phone.
Who, by the way, the news dropped yesterday of her and several other amazing people being cast in The Lion King.
The Lion King.
And a lot of people were like, y'all got to rename this The Lion Queen, obviously. Anyway, side note.
But yeah, so, you know, this office is not leaking, and they actually seem to be strategically holding information. Mm-hmm. And this is like a really important part of this, right?
Well, and then it kind of makes you wonder, what else do we not know that Mueller knows? Because I think a lot of prosecutors are also noting that Mueller's moving pretty fast.
Yeah.
And so what else is coming down the pike is a big question.
Exactly. And I mean, in terms of like opening moves, like this is a pretty spectacular one.
Yeah.
Right. He comes out the gate with major indictments against two high profile like guys who worked on the Trump campaign, and then a guilty plea with a foreign policy advisor from the Trump campaign.
Yeah.
So, like, this is pretty huge news, and I think that this did go fast. I've said this before, I will keep saying it. Watergate took over 900 days to resolve.
Yeah.
Mueller has been actively investigating. He was assigned to this about 6 months ago.
I mean, less than that. 5 months.
Less than that.
Yeah.
5 months ago. So like, I can't even imagine what we're going to know at day 900, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this is just... There is a lot going on here. It is very dense. And eventually we're going to know what happened. And, you know, if you weren't sure of that before, I think these indictments really show that Mueller has direction and is going to get to the truth.
Well, and so here's what else is interesting to me before we wrap up this section. So there was a lot of talk about Papadopoulos being a quote unquote proactive cooperator.
Right.
Which would indicate that there's a good chance that he was wearing a wire in communications with other Trump associates and possibly helping to sort of incriminate.
Right. This is a bad spy novel that we're living in.
It's a horrible spy novel. But, I mean, just because he might be a proactive cooperator doesn't mean that he did that. That's just an interesting note. Right. But also, Pete Williams on NBC was saying, well, a lot of people are reporting that Papadopoulos is a proactive cooperator, but he said in reading the court documents, it sounded like the Mueller team was more hoping he would be a proactive cooperator. And so we don't even necessarily know that he has been, again, to say this word again, proactive cooperator. But that's a really interesting nugget. And then the other interesting nuggets for me to sort of bring it back to Manafort. Number one, Rachel Maddow had sort of reminded everyone on Twitter the other day that Attorney General Jeff Sessions has not said whether he will recuse himself from anything related to Paul Manafort specifically. So he has recused himself from Russia-related things, and that's why Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein is overseeing the special counsel investigation,
right,
or overseeing right. Robert Mueller, who is overseeing the special counsel investigation. That's really interesting to me. I think that's something just sort of to keep our minds on. Also, I think we have to think about the fact that, you know, Paul Manafort, a reason why he might not want to cooperate is because maybe he thinks Donald Trump is going to pardon him. Right. And we talked about Joe Arpaio a couple of months ago and how that could be a trial balloon for all this Russia stuff should it get to serious indictments.
Yeah. And I think he might be dreaming a little bit on there, because I don't think anyone on Trump's team is going to let him pardon this asshole.
I wouldn't bank on that. I mean,
I'm not banking on it. I think
Trump has shown time and again he will completely flout
right
political norms, and he doesn't give right. a fuck about that. And I thought it was interesting, Manafort's lawyer, the first thing he said in his sort of mini press conference after the indictments came down was Donald Trump was right. And that right. felt to me, again, we don't know anything. This is purely just exploring this avenue, speculation. That to me felt like a signal to Trump, like sort of like sucking up, you know, because it was reported months ago that Trump had had asked about his ability to pardon staffers, associates, family members, and even himself. So right. it's something he's thinking about.
Well, that's totally true. Although would we spoke to actually one of our hellions, Olivia, you know, we were talking about the pardon power, and, you know, they also, in these indictments, they name unindicted or unknown co-conspirators. And so with conspiracy, every person that's part of that conspiracy gets charged with every crime in that conspiracy.
Right.
So if Donald Trump is considered a co-conspirator, I mean, the question sort of becomes, can he even pardon Manafort or anyone involved in this conspiracy? Because then he would effectively be pardoning himself, which we don't have precedent on.
Lots of unexplored questions, because we have never really had a president who has sort of stretched the rule of law, arguably, in this way. And also, right. it's important to note that pardons don't extend to state-level prosecution.
Right. And there's reports that there are parallel state investigations that would not be subject to a presidential pardon.
Right.
So, you know, this is all very fascinating. And, you know, like I said, we don't know everything, but it's really starting to come into sharper focus.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it comes to these kind of crimes, and when it comes to taking down, like, the big bad boss, right? Again, since we're talking about bad spy novels, like, you know, if you're going after organized crime, you kind of do it in a spiral. You start with the outer edges. You start with the driver of the getaway car, right? And you get them to admit to what happened, and you give them a deal, and you kind of spiral in, you know, getting higher and higher level players to, you know, and giving them deals and getting them to talk and getting in, you know, sort of ramping up to the big bad guy at the center.
Yeah. I mean, it's indictment o'clock in America.
It's indictment o'clock.
And I think there's, I personally believe there's more to come.
Oh, 100%. Julie Balutis is a technology consultant and longtime Democratic volunteer organizer, strategist, and passionate advocate for local politics and volunteerism. She's moonlighted on 3 presidential, 4 gubernatorial, 8 Senate, and 16 House races, because she hates sleep, apparently, and too many local campaigns to count. This is her second time as a guest on Hellbent, and she was kind enough to co-host with me back in August, and we are so excited to have her back on the show. So welcome, Julie.
Thank you. I am so delighted to be here again. When Sarah reached out about me coming back to talk about the Virginia election, I told her that my new life goal is to be the Alec Baldwin of Hellbent. Like, yes. I'm just going to keep just showing up until eventually I'm just walking around in a velvet bathrobe and making noise in the background. And they're going to be like, oh, there's Julie. She's over there as usual. But thank you for having me back on. I'm really excited to be here again.
Official weird Hellbent headquartered team member with velvet
yes.
robe.
That is me.
Yeah, so like you mentioned, we want to talk about the Virginia's governor's race. The election is on Tuesday, so the 7th. So coming up very quickly. And so can you kind of tell us about how the Virginia governor's race has played out over the last couple of months?
Yeah, I definitely can. So first, I want to give some quick background on this election for anyone who hasn't been fully immersed in it the way we are here and the way that people who aren't constantly obsessed with local and state politics are. Our candidates for governor are the Democrat Ralph Northam and the Republican Ed Gillespie. Ralph Northam is an Army veteran and pediatric neurologist. He's been our lieutenant governor since 2013, and he was a state senator for a few years before that. Ed Gillespie is a former lobbyist and a Republican Party chair who ran for Senate in 2014 and came really, really close to unseating Mark Warner in that election.
Oh.
Warner was very popular at the time, so that was a big surprise. The polling didn't have it close at all. So he is kind of looking for a resurgence here and kind of a redemption song and trying to win the governorship. Both Northam and Gillespie had tough primary challengers. Northam's was Tom Perriello, who was a former congressman from the Charlottesville area. We talked about that a lot the last time I was on. It was a really well-fought race, but Northam ended up winning by about 12 points. Gillespie had a much closer primary race, and unexpectedly so. You know, once again, he sort of ended up in a very close race, this time not to his advantage. He was being challenged by Corey Stewart, who is the chair of the Prince William County Board of Supervisors and who kind of boasts about being Trump before Trump existed. He was considered, very cool,
Great.
He's really into Confederate flags and statues, very racist, very xenophobic. He was considered a long shot candidate, but ended up coming very close to beating Gillespie, who squeaked out a win by barely a point.
So
that was kind of where we left off in June. I think the last time I was on as a guest, we were about a week away from the primary election. So that's how that shook out. And that's how we went into the general. Post-primary, on the Democratic side, Tom Perriello conceded with an extraordinary amount of class and grace within minutes of the race being called, immediately endorsed Northam, and actually that night appeared on stage with him with the full slate of primary candidates, winners and losers, in a show of party unity. It was great. And since then, he's been all over the state. He started a PAC called Win Virginia, which is dedicated to electing down ballot candidates. And he's been in the parts of the state where he performed better than Northam, kind of working for the whole ticket, but especially our down ballot candidates and trying to flip the House. And because of his work,
That is amazing. That is a level of non-pettiness that I will never achieve.
100% I'm not going to subtweet anyone here, but if you're actually committed to electing Democrats and making sure that Democrats succeed in elections, this is exactly how you handle a primary loss.
Absolutely.
So they were able to emerge with, you know, nearly all of both candidates' supporters aligned and pushing for the common good, which obviously in this case is electing Northam and Justin Fairfax and Mark Herring as our governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general.
So what are the issues? You know, you mentioned, you know, that Perriello has sort of been, you know, campaigning with Northam and getting these down ballot seats. So what are the issues that have really been focused on over the last couple of months and in the run up to this election?
Yeah, so Virginia is one of only two states that elect a governor the year after a presidential election. And as a state that borders Washington, D.C., and whose suburbs house thousands of D.C. insiders, the governor's election here is always kind of a referendum on the new presidential administration.
Right.
The new president is always an issue here, but even more so this year. Trump has been a central focus on both sides. Yeah. Northam has obviously repudiated him at every turn, and Gillespie has basically ignored him publicly while also trying to pander to his base by kind of dog whistling to Confederate sympathizers and white supremacists that Corey Stewart was popular with. Most people know we had a terrorist attack here in Virginia in August when a group of white supremacists and neo-Nazis descended on Charlottesville with tiki torches and assault weapons, and they wanted to protest the potential removal of a Confederate statue. One of them, of course, drove into a crowd of peaceful protesters and killed a young woman, Heather Heyer. Since then, of course, Confederate statue removal has become a central narrative in the campaign. The majority of Virginians do not favor removing the statues. Northam favors taking them down. Gillespie does not, and has sent out, you know, mailers to that effect. And it's really become a key focus to the detriment of, you know, real issue. Confederate statues are obviously a real issue, but it has not been a policy-driven campaign from a public perspective. The media is not really covering either candidate's real policies.
Right. It really has seemed to become about these statues. And I also have heard like news and sort of things on Twitter about people who know Gillespie, you know, kind of were surprised and disappointed by the campaign he ran. So it was sort of an ugly campaign from what I understand. Can you kind of tell us about the uglier parts of Gillespie's campaign and how there's this sort of, you know, idea that he trumped up his campaign and how that kind of played out?
Yeah, he clearly took his near defeat in the primary to heart and responded by shifting gears to, you know, heavily pander to the Corey Stewart faction, the Trumpers. He has, as the months have gone by, run an increasingly bigoted and race-baiting campaign, which has culminated in just unbelievably racist and fear-mongering attack ads and mailers in the past few weeks and months, which just keep getting more audacious. And that's trickled down to Republican candidates on the local ballots as well, who are running for state House seats. In our 13th House district, the incumbent Republican Bob Marshall, who's being challenged by Democrat Danica Rome, who's a transgender woman. Marshall has sent out mailers intentionally misgendering her.
What?
And in several other districts, the GOP has targeted Black and Latina women candidates by associating things like restoring voting rights to people who've served time for felonies with support of violent criminals. So in a lot of ways, the campaign that Republicans have run in Virginia this cycle has been as ugly, if not more so, than Trump's in 2016.
Wow. It's
been pretty terrible to see all the way down the ticket. What Gillespie is doing really well is kind of threading the needle between your sort of garden variety Republican who wouldn't consider themselves a racist, but are way too willing to overlook it.
Right.
While kind of dog whistling to these more outwardly racist factions in other parts of the state and even some in Northern Virginia as well.
Yeah.
In the last couple of weeks, some of the Democratic groups have struck back to kind of try to highlight Gillespie's pandering to racist Confederates, and they've taken some media heat for that. So where we are in a week, the last week before Election Day, is a neck and neck race between what I think is a good guy and a very bad guy, with a fun dollop of media both sides-ism thrown in for good measure, which is a year after 2016 is eerily familiar and disturbingly so.
Yeah. And that also, it sounds vicious. Like
it is.
The kind of campaign tactics and those mailers that you're describing, it doesn't sound like, to me at least, like politics is normal. It sounds more personal and more vicious. And that's kind
it really
of
is.
The feeling that I've been getting out of Virginia. Obviously, I don't live there, so I can't speak exactly to that. But it's just felt very icky. Is that the adult word?
Oh, very much
to use?
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And you think about, if you know anything about Ed Gillespie, a lot of people don't, but he's absolutely a party guy. Like, he is the swamp personified.
Yeah.
He is absolutely, I mean, he was a lobbyist. He was heavily involved in the oil industry. He chaired the Republican Party for years. If you want Republican establishment, it's Ed Gillespie. So the fact that he is able to so successfully glom on to this kind of scary, racist, populist, white nationalist movement and exploit their hatred while also kind of riding the normal Republican horse is pretty disturbing.
That is pretty disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really awful.
Yeah.
You know, and we talked about this last time you were on, but we talked about how this campaign was nationalized early on, right? Everyone was talking about the race and the primaries. And so do you think that has affected the race and how it's played out?
I think it has. I think especially around issues like the statues, I think that's become more of a national issue than a local one, given how people in Virginia feel about it versus how people nationally feel about it. We talk about national endorsements. Our revolution was involved in Tom Perriello's campaign and has not endorsed Northam, which I think is fine. Our races here are always nationalized because of when we vote. So we're kind of used to that. It's more noticeable this year because of Trump and because of everything abnormal that's happening in the administration in Washington and nationally, with this resurgence of white nationalism and populism. This is definitely the first gubernatorial race I can remember in recent history where, you know, national news outlets and high profile podcasts and this much national attention is focused on us and this much import is being given to the outcome of our election.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, like Joe Biden endorsed Danica Rome, the transgender woman who's running. And it felt like sort of a low level like ticket for a former VP to endorse.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of that, like, it feels really nationalized.
Yeah. And to some extent it's good, right? Because we have a very restrictive voter ID law here, and having groups like Let America Vote come in from elsewhere in the country and help us out making sure that voters have the right ID and know how and when to vote and are empowered and enabled to vote is a huge, huge deal. And all of the, you know, national phone banking is huge. The donations are a big deal. So that is all really helpful. So in some ways, having a nationalized race can be really good. It's just kind of finding that line between the helpful and the harmful. And I think for the most part, the national Democrats have done a good job capitalizing on that.
So, so what are the stakes here? So could you kind of take us through what a Northam governorship would mean versus a Gillespie governorship?
I can. I don't want to sound too dramatic. I'm afraid I will. Anyway, the stakes are through the roof. The stakes could not possibly be higher. And that goes for both national and local levels. From a national standpoint, the whole country's watching us. We are on, you and I are on different coasts talking about this right now. One week before the election, the outcome of this race will be a huge, huge factor, first of all, in determining how the GOP moves forward into 2018 for House, Senate, and governor's races. Ed Gillespie, as I kind of mentioned, is walking a tightrope right now. He is trying to appeal to so-called moderate Republicans by making the right noises about taxes and conservative policy and so forth. But he's also playing the Trump card to appeal to racist and xenophobic voters. And if he's successful, if that works, the Republican Party has then nailed down their blueprint for keeping the House, for retaining or flipping governor's mansions, and keeping a tight lock on their Senate majority, which is already a tough pull for Democrats to make a dent in anyway. Right. And the fact that Gillespie has had so much success using racism and fear-mongering to close the gap in this race, where at one point Northam was significantly up, is really terrifying to me. And conversely, has Republican strategists absolutely chomping at the bit to see if it works so they can do it again.
Honestly, that's more terrifying than I thought you'd say, because I hadn't even thought of that.
I'm not even done yet. I have more.
You have more. Yeah. I mean, but it's such a good point. I mean, it is really creating a blueprint for how these races can be won moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're testing the waters to see, will they be repudiated by so-called traditional conservatives if they take these really ugly tacks by playing to racist fears? And so far, the answer is no. I mean, by all accounts, by all numbers, Ed Gillespie's racist tactics that he's using in this campaign are helping him. Right. He has gained in the polls. He has not lost significant support among suburban Northern Virginians, and he's gained support in, you know, kind of rural Virginia. And that is a very dangerous combination going into the last week of the election. And it will definitely, definitely be looked at as a strategy to use going forward in both close and not close, you know, red, purple, blue states going forward.
Why are local elections and these sort of less sexy elections like state houses and state legislatures, you know, why are they important in general? And can you speak to this like sort of larger issue of people not being invested in these smaller, you know, non-national elections?
Yeah. I mean, local elections are important for so many reasons. I mean, the most important of which is that who you elect to serve you at the local level has the most impact on your day-to-day life.
This is one thing. I have explained this over and over. It's like, these are the people who work directly for you and affect change in your community. Like,
yeah. And another really important thing is that they're accessible to you, right? Like you can go to your city council meeting. You can talk to your city council people or your county board, wherever you live. Your local officials are the people who have to listen to you. And they're and if you pull back and look at it from a little bit of a wider lens, it's good party building. For Democrats, it builds our bench. And something that has really suffered in the last decade is our bench. And we do have a slate of really good Democrats who have come up through the ranks in some areas. But post 2016, you talk about, you know, tens of thousands of candidates running through Emily's List and Emerge America and Run for Something and things like that. These are all people that we'll see in the foreseeable future, regardless of what happens in their current elections. I mean, all you have to do to look at what's happening on the Democratic bench and how we're building it is who's running in Virginia right now. And I touched on it a little bit, how many seats Republicans have. And typically we don't fight for them. You know, we assume that we can't win. X district is too red. This is hopeless. There's no money in this race. There's no money in the job. Why bother if I can't win? But 2016 lit a fire under Democrats all over the country, and especially so in Virginia, where we have the rare opportunity to immediately fight back against something like a Trump election, right?
Right.
You know, within a year, we can say, we repudiate you. We don't believe this. We don't stand for this. And we're coming back.
Right. Talk about instant gratification.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, in 2015, Democrats competed for 21 of the, at the time, 65 seats or 67 seats Republicans held. And this year we're challenging 54 of the 66. And that is just an astronomical increase. We have 43 women running, and they run the gamut from single moms and military vets and doctors and farmers and reporters, you name it. Like, we have a Democratic candidate who's done it and who is using that experience to run for office this year. They're diverse, they're brilliant, and they're so driven, regardless of how many win on November 7th. That's our future. That's the future of the party in Virginia and in our nation. And we're going to see a lot more of that next year, I think, in state legislatures and elections going forward.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Yeah, I think building a bench is something that I didn't hear until I started to sort of embed myself in politics in a, you know, more like up close way. But yeah, I mean, getting people just to try running, to win a quote unquote small seat and get the experience, you know, use that to then build and say, this person served as a city council person and now they're running for this. And so there's like a logical progression, and building that progression is so important. And I think that is often lost in these discussions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, one last note on the down ballot folks is they drive turnout and they drive enthusiasm in the party. So you have in previous elections in 2014 or 2013, I'm sorry, Terry McAuliffe kind of squeaked by our incumbent attorney general at the time, Ken Cuccinelli, who was, oh my goodness. Like, he was
Ken Cuccinelli. Just,
yeah. I'm sorry. I lost my words. He's Ken Cuccinelli. He's horrible.
He was horrible.
And Terry McAuliffe should have whooped him. And that was also very close. And I think part of the reason for that is that there was not a lot of party enthusiasm.
Right.
We didn't have a lot of people running down ballot, and having this many candidates running for 54 of 66 Republican seats, the DLCC announced last week that our House candidates in Virginia have knocked over a million doors this election cycle.
Wow.
And that I saw that and it blew my mind. Yeah. I have been a volunteer on every gubernatorial campaign since I was old enough to knock doors. And I have never heard a number like that.
Yeah.
A million doors is absolutely bananas. And I honestly think every time I get panicky about the election and what's happening, I just come back to that. And I have to believe that that kind of ground game and that kind of, you know, just drive to get out there and talk to voters really, really should make a difference on November 7th.
Yeah. Well, I am awaiting the November 7th vote. I cannot wait to see what happens. But I have a good feeling about this. So I'd like to thank you again, Julie, for joining us. She's also going to be joining me for our What Happened by Hillary Clinton book club for our $5 and up Patreon supporters this week. We're going to be doing it over the weekend, so you'll get that next week. It's going to be really, really fun.
Yeah, I'm excited.
It's going to be great. And you can follow her on Twitter at Resisterhood. And I cannot highly recommend enough that you do so. So thank you, Julie, again for joining us. This was so wonderful.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And we will, I'm sure we're going to want to talk to you after the election, no matter what happens.
Yeah. Send us lots of good juju. We're going to win next week.
Exactly. Okay, Sarah, so that was an amazing interview with Julie. She's always amazing.
Dude, I love Julie Bluttis. I'm just going
to
put that on record because she's amazing.
I know.
Yeah.
She is amazing, and she's so smart and so prepared. So a lot of really interesting, you know, discussion about the Virginia governor's election and also local politics in general.
Yes.
And like why it's so important to pay attention to these more local, you know, maybe quote less sexy.
Well, and I think it's an important thing to talk about in tandem with the Russia investigation, because
100%.
As much as we are all sort of interested and invested in what Robert Mueller might find, ultimately we can't change the sort of what's happening in this administration
right.
if we don't change the Congress, at least.
Right. Well, and
governors and state legislatures and all that
exactly,
stuff.
Exactly. And, you know, the people who affect the most change in your direct community are your local elected officials.
Yep.
So, you know, getting involved on that level. And this is also a testament to we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can talk about these Mueller indictments and this guilty plea. And we can also talk about these important elections that are coming up. You know, it's not mutually exclusive.
For sure.
So, you know, on that note, let's move on to gratitude checks.
Yes.
So, Sarah, what are you grateful for today?
So I am grateful for Rebecca Traister, which is kind of an evergreen gratitude check.
She's so great.
One of my favorite writers, and she's just brilliant. She talks about gender and how it relates to overarching power structures in really interesting and nuanced ways. Like, every column of hers is a must read, I think.
Yes, I completely agree.
Yeah. So I wanted to give a shout out to her, but specifically this column she wrote on sort of the heels of Harvey Weinstein and other figures in entertainment getting exposed, because there have been men who inhabited top levels of media companies who are also being found out to be sexual predators. So sort of more open secrets getting out there in the public domain. And Rebecca Traister writes about how these are the men who have been and who are, because you bet your ass there are still more of them out there, you know, they are the men who have been shaping media narratives. And it's no coincidence that these overarching narratives are misogynist in nature. Like, you cannot untangle those two things, right? So it's a great article. We're going to link to it in the show notes, but I want to just highlight a couple of quotes from the piece. So she said, quote, "We see that the men who have had the power to abuse women's bodies and psyches throughout their careers are in many cases also the ones in charge of our political and cultural stories. Lots of people still strain against the argument that gendered power structures helped determine Hillary Clinton's and thus our nation's fate. But when they do, they are too often thinking of gender as an attribute that belongs only to her, the woman, and not to the men whose gender afforded power ensured that she would have to work around and against so many dicks in her efforts to become the first woman president." And she's using dicks in the colloquial sense, like dick
ones. Right. And
then she goes, "And while it may feel cathartic for some women to finally get to say things they've been waiting years to say, this does not undo the damage. We can't go back in time and have the story of Hillary Clinton written by people who have not been accused of pressing their erections into the shoulders of young women who worked for them." Ooh. And I thought that was just such an incisive point. And I think about that a lot, because in the immediate aftermath of the election, and we've talked about this before in the podcast, I felt like anytime me or other women tried to talk about how sexism was a significant factor, among many others, in Hillary Clinton's defeat, we were shouted down by so many men. Right. Yeah. And so it's like we have these men who are shaping our media narratives, and then we have droves of dudes who are denying that these narratives are misogynist in nature, and therefore we're not allowed to talk about them, which for me is like a QED of sexism. Like, sexism is so deeply layered and endemic to our culture that either you don't see it or you refuse to see it, and you're not allowing women to talk about it, you know?
Right. And I think, like you said, it's impossible to tease those two things out, right? It's impossible to tease out the fact that the cultural and political narrative is shaped by men.
Yep.
And that
white
men are also the ones abusing women.
Yeah. And it's white men, right?
And it's white men.
Yeah. So it's like misogyny doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's not specific to Hillary Clinton. You know, a lot of people like to say, oh, but I just, you know, but that's Hillary. Hillary doesn't operate outside of sexism. She's in a lot of ways a big prime fucking example of sexism. And these men, like Rebecca Traister points out, are not outside of sexism. And too often we forget about the sort of gendered dynamics around the men who tell these stories. We focus on the women who are the recipients, or the that's not a great word, but the on the receiving end of sexism.
Right, right.
So then I just want to read one last quote. So she says, it is a rich irony, perhaps lost on Wieseltier. So he's one of the dudes who's been exposed as a sexual predator. So it is a rich irony, perhaps, that he, that the history of America has been one of wholly mediocre white men wielding unearned influence, often building their power by stoking resentments against non-white men via belittlement, vilification, and derision. So it's like kind of this vicious cycle, right? And it's it's in order to maintain power structures that keep pretty much everyone else down and keep one group, i.e. white men, dominant. So I just thought it was a brilliant piece, and I just really fucking appreciate and am grateful for her voice.
Yeah. No, that was a great gratitude check. I love that.
Thank you. Okay, so after that mouthful from me, what are you grateful for? Is it, it's not bats this week. It's something political.
Although yes, it is something political, which is so weird for me. Mm-hmm. Although I am still grateful for bats. I'm not going to lie. But anyway, so actually this week it's my turn to be grateful for an independent judiciary.
Yes. I know usually I'm on that grind, but I like that you are now too.
I know. So basically, parts of the transgender service member ban has been struck down by the courts. So a judge on the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia ruled on Monday that Trump's, you know, basically directive changing the transgender policy back to what it was before June 2016 and banning new transgender recruits from enlisting cannot be enforced while this case is being reviewed in court. So that's good. So basically, the judge Colleen Kohler Cotley, wrote, "The court finds that a number of factors, including the sheer breadth of the exclusion ordered by the directives, the unusual circumstances surrounding the president's announcement of them, aka Twitter, the fact that the reasons given for them do not appear to be supported by any facts, and the recent rejection of those reasons by the military itself, strongly suggests that the plaintiff's Fifth Amendment claim is meritorious." So, too long, didn't read, is basically, she was like, yeah, you can go fuck right off with this bullshit.
It's very Derek Watson-esque, where it's like, none of this makes fucking sense. Like, none what of are this you makes doing? Sense.
I also love that the courts, specifically this judge, took into account the fact that this was announced on Twitter. She was like, that is some serious bullshit, right? Like, that's not how, you know, that's not how you announce these sort of things. And so the government argued that since the policy is still within Mattis's 6-month review period, the plaintiffs didn't have standing as the policy has not yet affected their service. And she basically said, good try, fuck off to that as well.
Interesting.
You know, and she said, the circumstances provide additional support for plaintiffs' claim that the decision to exclude transgender individuals was not driven by genuine concerns regarding military efficacy.
Yeah.
So basically she's saying this has no basis in reality.
Right.
And I don't know why the fuck we're talking about it.
This does not make any goddamn policy sense. This is...
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So she ruled that the military policy will revert to status quo. So as it was before the ban was announced or signed until the case has been reviewed by the courts. So legal translation by Devin Handy, go fuck yourself. We see what you're trying to do.
Yes. Although I did see that the judge denied the plaintiff's motion to block the ban on funds for gender reassignment surgery. So it wasn't a sort of sweeping victory in my mind. I think that there's still parts of this proposed policy that need to be struck down.
She did rule that any, you know, that because going back to the status quo, healthcare is still provided to transgender individuals, there's just still this injunction on gender reassignment surgery.
So they don't consider that healthcare?
Right. Right. Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's definitely not perfect. What she said in her ruling was basically she doesn't have jurisdiction over the healthcare policy. She was only ruling on the
ban.
The ban.
Gotcha. Right?
So it wasn't part of her ruling because it wasn't part of the scope of this particular case.
Gotcha.
Yeah, but I thought that that was a really great thing that happened. And the independent judiciary is fucking badass.
Yeah, and it also reminds me that as much as we've seen sort of victories in the court system, I don't think that we can hang our hats on that remaining to be true because of the way that Trump and, you know, Mitch McConnell are trying to pack the courts. I know I sound like a broken fucking record, but seriously, this is why elections fucking matter. Like, they have consequences, and it's like, yeah, I just want to yell at
such an asshole is sitting in a stolen Supreme Court seat.
Right.
I mean,
yeah, we should never forget that.
I literally will never, ever let that go.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm writing that on my tombstone.
Seriously. I can't get over it. Especially because, like, Merrick Garland never even got a fucking you know what? I can't get into this.
Right I know. We're,
now. It'll literally just
we're gonna
piss
go
me
down
off.
A really rage-filled path, which is, I mean, to be fair, that's every day.
That's every day. But yeah. So yeah, the, you know, packing the courts, it's really scary. But at least for now, the independent judiciary is sort of saving our ass here.
All right, Devin, so let's get into our Hellion of the Week, which is what we do on Thursdays. On Mondays, we do our Dickwad of the Week. On Thursdays, we like to sort of end the week strong and identify a particular badass. And I've been waiting to give this person Hellion of the Week for a while because she is so fucking amazing. Who is it?
It is Joy Ann Reid.
Oh, I love her.
I know. She's amazing. So on her show on Sunday, she had a panel on about sort of the Russia indictments that were coming from Mueller's office. They hadn't been unsealed yet, and so they were kind of discussing like
what might
sort
happen.
Of the what they were going to be. So she had a woman named Jen Kearns on, and she was a writer for the Washington Examiner. And basically, Joy Reid took Jen Kearns to task for trying to make Uranium One happen. Because it's not going to happen, Gretchen. It's just not.
And we, not to give a plug to ourselves, but if you haven't listened to last week's podcast, we talked about that sort of bullshit. Around Uranium One. But Joy Reid took this woman to task. It was honestly just such a beautiful sight to see. It was absolutely. I watched this clip like at least 20 times.
It was a very classy go fuck yourself from Joy. And it was delivered with this journalistic integrity that we've come to love about her. She literally made Jen Kearns discredit her own story by asking fact-based questions.
Yeah.
You know, and so basically Jen Kearns was trying to pivot this story about these indictments to the Uranium One or Steele dossier sort of stories and how the Democrats and Hillary Clinton are really the ones that should be investigated for collusion because that makes perfect fucking sense.
That's my favorite. I think that's my favorite Trump conspiracy theory that like Hillary Clinton colluded with Russia to lose election. Like she's so incompetent, she couldn't even collude to win. I mean,
I don't understand any of this. And I think one of my favorite moments in the clip was Joy Reid asked Kearns the name of the person who was supposedly at the center of this like Uranium One Clinton Foundation quote unquote scandal. And Jen Kearns couldn't name the person.
Yeah.
And it was very embarrassing for her. And I'm petty as fuck. And I enjoyed that very, very much.
Well, like the way Joy did it was brilliant because she was just like, boom, it was like a lightning round. Boom.
Exactly.
Like, what is this? What is this? And then she like sort of was like, these two things have nothing to do with each other. Like you're making something, you know, ships sailing in the night. You're trying to make it nefarious and it's not.
Right. Yeah. And she just, I love that she made Jen Kearns discredit her own story. Like she didn't have to do it. She made her do it. Like that's amazing.
By
that's
asking
so perfect.
Fact-based questions. I mean, it's literally like journalism 101, but taking to such a fucking another level. And it's like, it reminded me of how desperately, on so many different levels, we need more Joy Reids in media.
Yes. Okay, Sarah, last but not least, we've got some action items. So something our Hellions can do after they listen to the show. So what do you have for us first?
Yeah, so we have an election-based trio of action items. So, you know, we've been giving shouts to this for the last several podcasts, but just to sort of hammer the point home a little more, we want to encourage our Virginia Hellions to get out the vote for Ralph Northam on November 7th and to tell all your friends to get out the vote. It's a really important election. I think that there's a lot riding on this election, I think. And, you know, for everyone else, Flippable has a great sort of comprehensive list of elections that are also happening on November 7th. So check that list and see if an election is happening in your area and make sure you get out to vote and you also encourage friends and family to do so as well.
We have another one for Florida Hellions. There is a petition to put the restoration of voting rights on the Florida 2018 ballot. So you can sign that petition at floridarc.com/volunteer. And you can sign this petition to get this on the ballot to restore voting rights to those that have been disenfranchised. So that is a really good thing to do.
And I said a trio of election related action items. That was fake news. That was an alternative fact, because the third item is actually around healthcare. So getamericacovered.org is a great resource. The open enrollment for Obamacare starts November 1st, which already happened. Right. And it goes through December 15th. And yes. So that, I believe, is a shorter time period than in years past. And it's
only 45 days. So.
And it's sort of like another indication of the way the Trump administration is sort of trying to sabotage ACA. So I would say get the word out there. Make sure you're tweeting about it. Make sure you're telling your friends. And also, if you need healthcare, now's the time to sign up.
Those are, you know, good things to do. You know, recently we've liked to end the show with a quote from another badass feminist lady. So this week's quote is from Harriet Beecher Stowe. She said, quote, "Women are the real architects of society."
That is the damn truth.
I know. We talked about how, you know, Sarah, you were saying how, you know, men often shape the political and cultural narrative. And obviously we have all of these men colluding with Russia. But at the end of the day, you know, women are the ones who have been doing the quiet, you know, work, sounding the alarm, writing these pieces, who are really like pulling our shit together.
Yeah. Women are just like the real MVPs, I feel like. And we often don't get enough credit, like you said, for the sort of unglamorous behind the scenes invisible labor.
I think that that's a really powerful note to end on, especially in this bananas week of Trump related news. So that does it for our show today, but we will see you back here on Monday. For more information on today's episodes, including links to the articles we discussed and additional resources, you can visit us online at hellbentpodcast.com.
And you can follow us across social media platforms. We're at HellbentPod on Twitter and Instagram. We're Hellbent Podcast on Facebook. And if you want to join our Facebook group, we are facebook.com/groups/dickwadsbegone. You can also follow myself, Sarah Lerner, on Twitter at Sarah Lerner. And you can also follow Devin on Twitter at Devin Handy.
We also have a Patreon if you would like to support us that way.
Yes, and you can find us on patreon.com/hellbentpodcast, and your support would mean a lot.